Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. And actually, I'm going to start with our article from The Complete Guide to Memory by Centennial Health Magazine. In the last episode, I was reading about subject HM, who was epileptic and had a surgery which cured his epilepsy but destroyed his short-term memory. And we had a few paragraphs left, and I would like to go ahead and include those along with a little sidebar article that was included here, too. So, amnesiacs know very well who they are. Milner told this person, disagreeing with the author that had written a book about it. They know all about their early lives, even if they suffered a touch of postoperative retrograde memory loss. The rest is not affected at all. They hold on to their childhoods and other formative events. They don't change their personalities, you know, she added. Milner predictably scoffed when I told her about the novel's romantic plot. You're not going to fall in love with an amnesiac patient, she said. I don't think anybody is. The great irony is that invaluable insights into the mysteries of memory, thanks to H.M. and his fellow patients, came about after acts of tragic misjudgment, Scovel's and others. These psychosurgeons believed they were doing a tremendous service to unhappy patients, their distressed families, and the community by performing procedures like prefrontal lobotomies. Yet they reflected a larger cultural standard of control and conformity, which too often led to imprudent decisions, particularly with the mentally disabled. As the surgeries continued, lives were irrevocably damaged and destroyed. And the sidebar article is titled Celluloid Memory Loss. Amnesia has always been a topic of horror and awe in film. What if the woman of your dreams is an amnesiac who forgets about you every morning? This is the central conceit of the bittersweet comedy 50 First Dates from 2004. In film as well as life, memory loss evokes anxiety, disorientation, existential terror, and humor all in one. Cinema's most popular amnesia trope focuses on lost identity, far scarier and plot-worthy than misplacing car keys or forgetting a face. Who am I? Asks the bewildered amnesiac character as onlookers empathize helplessly or take advantage. In The Bourne Identity of 2002, Jason Bourne simultaneously struggles to find out who he is and why people want him dead, while luckily hanging on to his foreign language and combat skills. Identity can also be altered deliberately. The Manchurian Candidate of 1962 analyzes the aftermath of wartime brainwashing. Memory substitution pairs with memory loss to tragic ends. Top prize for originality has to go to Memento of 2000. The brain-injured protagonist knows who he is, but, like H.M., can remember nothing new. The way he tries and fails to accurately externalize his experiences and facts through a series of labeled snapshots brilliantly symbolizes the fallibility of normal human memory. And finally, in more recent years, cinema has been exploring the irreversible ravages of dementia when the self slips away bit by bit. Notable films include Away from Her, 2006, and The Father, 2020. The gradual erosion of identity and agency combined with short and long-term memory loss make for powerful, provocative storytelling. Now, from AARP, the magazine, let's look back in history again from the article Eyewitnessed History. We're going to do two today. The first one is Fall of the Berlin Wall by David Patton, 58, of Connecticut College, on the barriers crumbling. In September 1989, I got to West Berlin. I was 26 and a PhD student at Cornell University. It was a time of great change. People were trying to leave East Germany. Protests were going on. In October, East Germany's leader, Erich Ernst Paul Honecker, resigned. It was clear something important was going on, but nobody was talking about the wall coming down. That seemed a long way off, if it was to happen at all. On the afternoon of November 9th, I was listening to a press conference. A communist East German official was reading a new policy on how East Germans could leave the country, and he kind of messed it up. From what he was saying, it sounded like the Berlin Wall was going to open up, although that was not his intention. Crowds began to gather in East Berlin. I was in the West, so I couldn't see these crowds, but I knew the pressure was building. Eventually, some border guards opened gates, and the crowds from East Berlin poured into the West. The following morning, I went down to the wall. I have a picture of myself standing on the wall that day, celebrating. West Berlin was full of East Germans, and they were welcomed. There was a party atmosphere. Many from the East were driving their smoky East German cars, the Trabants. Everyone was delighted, because nobody expected it. Over the next days, the wall came crumbling down, and I have pieces of it. You could tell who was from the East by their clothing. They didn't have Western jeans, for example, and by their hairstyles. Little details stand out. I remember the West Berlin newspapers had inserts with free maps in them, because East German maps showed West Berlin as basically uncharted territories. So the newspaper maps inserted showed the East Germans where the streets were and how to get around. Many East Germans saw food items they had never seen before. Bananas were talked about at the time, but you wouldn't have been able to get bananas in East Berlin. In East Germany, I stayed in Germany for nearly another 2 years. I ended up moving to a cheap, dilapidated apartment in what was formerly East Berlin. And I was in Germany on October 3, 1990, when the country reunified. I was there researching German foreign policy, and I was able to include my experiences in my dissertation and later in a book. What I remember most importantly, I think, is how unexpected the fall of the wall was, how quickly it happened, and the lesson we can learn. Circumstances that you can take for granted can change so quickly. Just because things are the way they are today does not mean they will be like that tomorrow. And now the birth of the Mustang. Gail Wise, 80, a former schoolteacher, on a car story like no other. On April 15, 1964, I went with my parents to Johnson Ford, a car dealership, on Cicero Avenue in Chicago, to buy a new car. I was 22 years old and had just graduated from Chicago Teachers College. I had gotten a job in the suburbs, but I still lived at home, so I needed a car to get there. "I want a convertible," I told the salesman. "Come in the back room with me," he said. "I have something special to show you." We went into the back room, and there was this car under a tarp. He pulled off the cover, revealing this marvelous sky blue automobile. It looked sporty and small, and it had bucket seats. I loved it right away. The salesman explained that he wasn't supposed to show anyone this car, that it was going to debut 2 days later. But he let me buy it. It was a convertible and had all the bells and whistles. I paid $3,447.50. My parents loaned me the money. Many years would pass, decades in fact, before I would learn that I was the first person in the U.S. ever to buy a Ford Mustang. That day, when I drove out of the dealership, people were waving and asking me to slow down so they could see the car. Even police officers. The day after that, when I drove to my job, the 7th and 8th grade boys gathered around the car. They were so excited. I felt like a movie star. I wrote a letter to my boyfriend, Tom, now my husband of 56 years, about the car. He was in the Navy, out at sea, and when he wrote back to me, he told me he had never heard of a Ford Mustang. On April 17th, 2 days after I had bought my car, Ford Motor Company debuted the Mustang at the New York World's Fair in a ceremony with Lee Iacocca, who became known as the father of the Mustang. Suddenly, there were Mustangs everywhere. The car became so popular that Ford could not make them fast enough. My husband and I drove that car for 15 years. Then one day, he came home from work and said, "There's something wrong with the car." He put it in the garage and said he would fix it next week. That next week turned into 27 years. Tom saw a guy online claiming to be the first Mustang owner. He said he had bought his Mustang on April 14, 1964 in Canada, but I had bought mine on April 15th, and I had all the paperwork. Eventually, Ford verified that my Mustang was the first one sold in the U.S. Tom and I still drive our Mustang. The purchase in 1964 was just a chance encounter that has turned into a wonderful adventure. It feels like I won the lottery. And sure enough, here is a picture of Gail Wise with her Mustang. And man, it is gorgeous. And she has a big smile on her face. Now let's look at an article from AARP, The Bulletin, about your health, drugs that may cause hair loss. And first, I apologize for my pronunciation of some of these drugs. Suddenly losing your hair? The culprit may be prescription drugs. The patient was depressed. She had kidney disease, endured regular dialysis, and had undergone an aggressive medical regimen after doctors discovered blood clots. But that wasn't what was dimming the 49-year-old's spirits. "My hair is falling out," she lamented. Her doctors suspected the cause. She had been prescribed warfarin, an anticoagulation drug, to deal with her clotting issue. Within 3 weeks of switching to an alternative drug, apixaban, her hair stopped falling out and eventually grew back. Like turning gray, hair loss can be a natural part of aging. But alopecia, the medical term for hair loss, is a complex condition with many variations, from slow progressing balding, referred to as male or female pattern hair loss, to more rapid and patchy loss. Alopecia areata is a common form. Genetics, hormonal changes, inflammation, and even certain diseases, including, in some cases, COVID-19, can trigger temporary or permanent hair loss. And prescription drugs may also trigger excessive and sudden shedding. The secret life of your hair. Each hair on your head has its own individual life cycle. A strand grows between 2 and 8 years. Then, in a period of 2 or 3 weeks, it stops growing and rests for 3 to 4 months before detaching itself from the follicle. Your head of hair is a mixture of 85% to 90% actively growing hair and hair that's resting and waiting to shed. But when the body experiences a trauma, sudden, substantial shedding can occur. Triggers can include an acute illness, stress, a severe nutritional deficiency, rapid weight loss, or a drug that proves toxic to hair follicles. When a drug is the culprit, this leads to increased shedding a few months later, generally on top of the scalp. This condition is known as drug-induced telogen effluvium. Hair loss is a relatively rare side effect, but a variety of medications can cause it. Beta blockers, blood thinners, antidepressants, cholesterol-lowering drugs, certain non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, and hormone-related drugs like thyroid meds, hormone replacement therapies, or steroids. If you suspect a prescription drug may be linked to hair loss, consult your doctor immediately. It may be a sign of other health problems. And ask for a referral to a dermatologist. Dermatologists are extremely important in helping to diagnose hair loss and its causes, suggest potential treatments, and know expected outcomes, says Ashura Blazer, MD, a rheumatologist at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. Even when a new prescription is a primary suspect, medication associations with hair shedding and thinning are difficult to identify and confirm, says Carolyn Weiland, MD, a dermatologist specializing in hair loss at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Sometimes hair loss can be triggered by a combination of drugs, or patients may be prescribed a number of medications simultaneously, further confusing the diagnosis. Since it may take weeks or even months after the trigger event for hair loss to begin, it's often hard to know the exact cause. Sometimes hair loss can be reversed by changing the medication dosage, prescribing the brand name drug or an alternative drug, or adding B vitamins or folic acid. Still, even after the source is identified, it could take 6 months for the hair to be... Still, after the source is identified, it could take 6 months for the hair to begin growing back. Bottom line, sudden hair loss can be traumatic, but it may be reversible. It just takes time and some thoughtful detective work. Cynthia E. Keene is a contributing editor at Physics World, and she wrote this article. Now, we have a list of meds that can harm your hair. Ask your doctor about these drugs, which can cause hair loss among some patients. So we have anticoagulants, which include heparin, warfarin, coumadin, panwarfarin, or sofarin. Then there's antidepressants, mood stabilizers, bipolar disorder medications. And these include divalproex sodium, which is Depakote, fluoxetine, Prozac, lithium, Zoloft, or valproic acid. Next we have antimicrobial tuberculosis drugs, isoniazid, arthritis inflammation drugs, Enbrel, Arava, Rumatrex, Trexanol. Then there's blood pressure meds, ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, cholesterol-lowering meds, Lipitor and Lopid, epilepsy and anticonvulsant meds, Depakote, Lamictal, Tridione, and severe acne and psoriasis drugs, Soriatane, Accutane, and Absorica. And again, I apologize for my pronunciation. Now, on the section about your money, let's look at the scoop on internet job boards, also from AARP The Bulletin. Sift through the many options for finding a job you'll be happy with. Personal connections are great for landing work, but don't miss the value of a job posting website. Recruiters and human resource professionals surveyed last year by recruiting technology firm JobVite ranked job boards as a top source of high-quality hires, up there with internal hires and a company's own website. Since online job boards first appeared more than 25 years ago, they've grown immensely in size and utility. They've consolidated, too. Most U.S. traffic now goes to just a handful of sites. As of May 1st, there were an estimated 11.4 million job openings in the U.S., and plenty of those positions are listed on employment websites. We're seeing companies really beef up their offerings to attract and retain workers, said Andrew Seaman, senior editor at LinkedIn News. You may already be familiar with these sites, but as a refresher, we sought out the most current advice for using them. Join the crowd. For the broadest, deepest selection of jobs, go to websites with the biggest user traffic. See the accompanying table. We'll give you a list. Sites attracting the most job seekers are the most popular among companies as well, explains Alexis Weidenhammer, career advisor in the Adult Career Counseling Center at Oakland University in Michigan. That said, each site has its own strengths and special features. Indeed, and LinkedIn, for example, make refining your research easy, says Courtney Warnsman, a career coach in Austin, Texas. ZipRecruiter lets you see if an employer has reviewed your resume. Then get specific. Use the site's filters to narrow your results. You don't want to be overwhelmed with millions of returned positions, said Heather Tinsley-Fix, senior advisor for employer engagement at AARP. Filtering results by distance from a zip code is a first step, but you may also be able to refine by factors such as salary range and full-time versus part-time. Automate the job hunt. Once you've homed in on what you're looking for, most sites will let you set up an alert for newly posted jobs that match your criteria. The latest listings will then get pushed to your email address. That way, you will wake up each morning to a new set of possibilities. Research as well as search. You can use job listing sites to learn about the job market, says Marty Nimco, a career counselor in Oakland, California. Check out job titles, required skill levels, and other qualifications for jobs you find interesting. It's a clean, easy, free way to get a sense of what the market wants, Nimco adds. Search specialty job sites. Working in a particular field? Look for industry-specific sites like K12JobSpot.com for teachers. To find one, do a simple web search such as technology job sites, then check the results to see if they're useful. And ones for older workers. The AARP job board, jobs.aarp.org, lists openings from employers who seek experienced workers. Retirementjobs.com and agefriendly.org/jobs are other sites targeting older workers. A listing that displays an AARP Employer Pledge Program badge indicates that the organization is committed to hiring people 50 and older. And finally, beware of scams and spam. If an ad pops up for a different job board, you need not click on it. Warnsman says, your resume can get spammed to 50 to 500 different sites, and suddenly you're getting tons of stuff that is completely irrelevant, she adds. Also, be alert to telltale signs of scams, application fees, instant job offers, remarkably high pay, or a quick request for your Social Security number. Have your feelers out, Warnsman advises. That's when the fraud comes in. The author of this article was Sharon Walters, a former CPA, and she has written for Wired and other publications. Now, here are the top job sites. Unique visitors to each site, and how many millions? We have LinkedIn.com, 81 million. Now, this one has an asterisk. Figure is for all of LinkedIn, not just LinkedIn jobs. Then we have Indeed.com, 64.2 million. Glassdoor.com, 18.9 million. ZipRecruiter.com, 15.8. USAJobs.gov, 3.4. Monster.com, 2.8. SimplyHired.com, 2.6. CareerBuilder.com, 2.2. SnagAjob.com, 2 million. And finally, Robert Half, RobertHalf.com, 1.1 million. Now, a brief article from your AARP State News, North Carolina. Preparing to age. By 2029, every fifth North Carolinian will be 65 or older. By 2031, there will be more people 65 and older than there will be children. AARP North Carolina is working to ensure the state is prepared for this. It is a member of the newly created Task Force on Healthy Aging, a project of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. The panel will look at policies and strategies for falls prevention, food and nutrition security, mobility, and social connections for older residents. In North Carolina, health care costs for those 65 and older are expected to grow from $25 billion in 2017 to $69 billion in 2037, the Institute predicts. The task force will meet regularly until December, then publish a final report with recommendations for healthy aging. Stay apprised at aarp.org/NC. Well, today we have time to get back to a few money-saving tips. So let's look at some more grocery tips. Go all in on store brands. Many major grocery chains have greatly expanded their store brand lines, and their reputation for quality has improved. Chains are highly secretive about who makes their products, but simply compare the ingredients list with name brand versions to see how close they are. Store brands can run as much as 25% less than the name brand version. Use self-checkout. A study conducted by IHL Consulting Group reveals that people who use self-checkout spent less on impulse package purchases. This is likely because shoppers are paying attention to what they're buying as well as the prices when they're scanning goods themselves, rather than getting distracted by their phone or the magazine rack while a cashier is doing it for them. For food gardeners, focus on high-cost foods. Many of the most common garden vegetables, green peppers, zucchini, cucumbers, cost very little at the store come harvest time. Focus on edibles that routinely cost more at the store. That could include most fresh herbs, heirloom tomatoes, organic lettuces, and vegetables for ethnic or regional cuisines like Chinese choy, okra, tomatillos, or Jerusalem artichokes. Grow veggies that are easy to preserve or store. It's a shame to find yourself with so many peppers or greens that you can't even give them away before they rot or wilt. Tomatoes can be canned, beans can be canned, pickled or frozen. Plant some pickling cubes. Butternut and other winter squashes will last until spring in a cool, dry spot. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.